So we're ready to begin. So the challenge that I wanted to make for myself today, which wasn't so hard actually, this challenge, was that Purim is in 2 weeks. So I wanted to discuss Purim, but also wanted to continue on with our topic of Emunah. But the truth is that Purim and Emunah very much fit together, and it wasn't a very hard challenge to live up to try to combine these two topics into one class. So what I want to discuss today is really, I guess, the beginnings of the Purim story, which is the nation of Amalek. The nation of Amalek, the Torah records, we'll talk about the story, as kind of the antithesis of what Judaism believes in, the antagonists of the Jewish people, the ones who come to destroy all that we believe in, all that we stand for. That's the nation of Amalek. We have a mitzvah, number one, to never forget what it did to us, and number two, to eradicate this nation, which we'll discuss. But Amalek, in its deepest sense, is the opposition to Emunah in this world. And we'll discuss what that means. Amalek, as a physical nation and as a spiritual force, they stand up against all we believe in. And when we discuss Emunah, the constant connection and belief and living with God, Amalek stands up against that and tries to take that from us. So we've discussed how to build Emunah in the past month or two. But we have to discuss those things that detract from Emunah. And we will discuss that, I guess, over the next few weeks, things that may detract from Emunah, may have a pause or Purim in between. But Purim is a holiday that's all about Emunah. It's about seeing God's miracles in daily life. It's about seeing God's protection over the Jews in all situations. And the very beginnings of Purim, I guess the Purim season really begins with the reading of Parsha Zachar. We have during the month, beginning of the month of Adar, starting last week, and we have four different Torah readings, four parshios we call them, leading us up until Nisan, until Pesach time. The very first one we read last week was called Parsha Shkalim, which discussed the mitzvah of giving in a half shekel into the temple every single year. But the second of these four special readings is called Parsha Zachar, which we'll read, God willing, in two Shabbos from now, right before Purim. And that is the reading of the Torah, which discusses the eradication of Amalek, never to forget what they did, and our mitzvah to destroy them. Because really Amalek, understanding the reason they need to be destroyed, that's what leads us into the Purim story. Namely because Haman, notorious Haman who wanted to eradicate all the Jews, he hails from the nation of Amalek. He's referred to in the Megillah as Haman ha'Agagi, Haman who is the Agagite. Agag was the king of Amalek whose life was spared by King Saul. He's supposed to kill him. He did not kill him. He let him live. And Agag went on to have children and grandchildren and descendants who continued on the purpose of Amalek in this world. And Haman, in the Megillah, he was one of the descendants of Agag. So since Haman descends from Agag, Purim is the time where we look at the destruction of Amalek. Haman was the one who provoked us in the Purim story, tried to destroy us as a descendant of Amalek. And Haman is the one who we got to destroy on Purim itself. So we have to understand this nation of Amalek and who they were. To understand Purim and also to understand how they challenge our Emunah. So I want to start off with just discussing this mitzvah. I mean, we haven't discussed mitzvahs in a while. Hopefully we'll go back to that at a certain point. We're doing mitzvahs for a very long time. But there are several mitzvahs in Torah pertaining to Amalek. One, as I mentioned, is to remember what they did. And one is to eradicate them. You have to destroy them physically, kill them. And we'll discuss these two mitzvahs first, then we'll discuss what they stand for. So first and foremost, let's just read what the Torah says about Amalek. There's two different places the Torah discusses Amalek. One is in Parshas Beshalach in the book of Shmos, and one is in Parshas Kisetse in the book of Devarim. In the book of Shmos, it discusses the story of what Amalek did to us in the desert. And the story is introduced in a very important way. It talks about the Jews had just crossed over the sea when God split the sea. They're fresh out of Egypt, fresh over all these incredible miracles. They go out into the wilderness, and they're thirsty, and they have no water to drink. They go to Moshe, and they complain, they were thirsty for water. They said, why did you take us out of Egypt just to kill us in the wilderness? So Moshe prayed to God, and God said, okay, take them to the rock. This is actually not the famous rock story, this is a different rock story. The famous rock story much later on. Take them to a rock. He tells them at this point, take your staff with you. You should hit the rock. He tells them this time you should hit the rock. Next time he should hit the rock, this time he should hit the rock, and water will flow from the rock. Moshe does this, and water flows out for the people, and everyone has something to drink. So this account ends with the verse that states, this place was called Masa Umariva, which are both terms of tension or fighting. It's called a place of fighting. because the Jews, they brought up a complaint to Moshe, and they tested God, and they said, Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im ayin. Is God with us, or is he not with us? So the Jews questioned God. They had just seen all these miracles, they'd seen the 10 plagues, they'd seen the splitting of the sea, they're in the desert, and they questioned God, is he really going to protect us or not? Is he going to give us water to drink or not? Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu im ayin. Is God with us or not? Immediately the next verse says, and Amalek came. Vayavo Amalek. Amalek came, and they fought the Jews in a place called Rephidim. The story goes on that Moshe tells Joshua, go choose some soldiers to fight Amalek. Tomorrow I'm going to stand up on this hill. I'll hold the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua chose soldiers. He stood there on the hill along with Moshe, Aaron, and Hur stood on the hill. Hur was Moshe's nephew. And when Moshe would raise up his hands, the Jews would be victorious. When he lowered his hands, Amalek would be victorious. Moshe's hands became heavy. They supported him with a rock. They helped him hold up his hands. And the Jews fought Amalek that evening. And eventually Joshua overcame Amalek and was able to weaken them by the sword. So that's the account of the war against Amalek. The Torah then continues that Hashem tells Moshe, write this as a remembrance in the book and place it in the ears of Joshua, because I will erase the remembrance of Amalek from under the heavens. That's what God tells Moshe. Moshe built an altar, and he said, the hand is on the throne of God, which is a terminology for an oath. So there's an oath taken on the throne of God. There will be a war against Amalek for all generations. That's in the account in the book of Shmos. So what's so fascinating about Amalek, they came unprovoked. They had no reason to come. The Jews had just left Egypt. They weren't necessarily threatening Amalek in any way. And Amalek just came on the offensive and just came to attack the Jews. We'll discuss the deeper spiritual reason behind that. But they came unprovoked. And at the end, we have a very radical response to Amalek. God says, I swear to you that there'll be a war of God against Amalek for all generations. So that's how severe the crime of Amalek was. And God feels he has to, there's an oath taken that Amalek should be destroyed, there'll be a war of God against Amalek generation to generation. So that's the first time you find Amalek mentioned in the Torah in terms of the nation of Amalek. The other place where Amalek is mentioned is in the book of Devarim. And this is where the mitzvah of destroying Amalek is mentioned. And the mitzvah to remember what they did to us is mentioned. It says in Devarim chapter 25, you should remember what Amalek did to you on the road when you left Egypt. They happened upon you on the way. They attacked the weaklings that were behind you. You were tired and weary, and they didn't fear God. So it shall be when God, you know, gives you tranquility in the land, you go to Israel, from all your enemies around you, and the land that God has given you as a heritage, you shall erase the memory of Amalek from under the heavens. Don't forget about this. And that's what it says in the book of Devarim. So the two places you find the Torah where Amalek is mentioned, and we are told we have to be sure that we erase them. We eradicate them from existence. Do not forget about Amalek. So let's discuss just the rules of this mitzvah, which is very interesting, and then we'll discuss the meaning behind it. Yeah.
It's nothing new, but one part of the verse says, I will erase their memory.
Right.
And yet, we're commanded to remember.
Right.
So, we're going to talk about
that. That's interesting. Yeah, we'll try to talk about that a little bit. That's a good question. Very good question. So, just in terms of the actual command itself, what are we supposed to do, or not supposed to do? That's the question. Rashi says, who are we supposed to destroy? So Rashi says, every single remnant of Amalek, man, woman, and child, and their animals as well. That's what Rashi says. Very, very extreme type of mitzvah. And the entire nation, plus their animals, entirely destroyed. There are those who argue and say the animals aren't included, but certainly man, woman, and child is included in this mitzvah. We find that King Saul was commanded to destroy the animals. That could have been a separate command later on, but not the command of the Torah itself. But King Saul was the one who was given this charge of the first king of Israel to destroy Amalek. He failed in his task. He allowed the king and the animals to survive, and the king went on to have more children. But the mitzvah is definitely inclusive of man, woman, and child, possibly the animals as well. That's point number one. The question is the mitzvah upon every Jewish individual to kill Amalek, or is it only on the nation, on the king? Is it on women? Is it on men? Who's the mitzvah upon? So again, that's also subject to dispute. The Sefer HaChinuch, which is one of the books that we quote often in this class, he says that the individual has this command to kill a malik. However, it's only on males, not on females. So it's a mitzvah for men to kill a malik, not for women. There are those who argue with that and say women are also obligated to kill a malik. And there are some who say it's actually a mitzvah not on the individual, but only upon the Jewish king. So King Saul, King David, a Jewish king has to kill a malik, but it's not my individual mitzvah to kill a malik, according to some opinions. So we have that dispute. Is it individual's mitzvah to kill a malik, or is it only the king's mitzvah to kill a malik? Question would be, if you have a person from a malik in front of you in this room today, do you have any mitzvah to kill him or not? That'd be, you know, that's something to deal with. Bottom line, nowadays, besides other issues involved in killing people, we say that we're not sure who actually is a genealogical descendant of this nation. The Talmud tells us that King Sanherib, one of the kings of Assyria, who lived during the times of the First Temple, he came in when he was conquering the world, and he actually moved all the nations around to different countries. So the people who are living in the country called Amalek at the time weren't even Amalekites anymore, because Amalekites were moved elsewhere. It says Bilbel's Umos. He came in and he confused all the nations, Sanherib. That's what he did. And therefore, any lineage based on the country of origin is meaningless to us nowadays. So essentially nowadays, we cannot know who is from Amalek, and we have no mitzvah to kill anybody, God forbid, because we don't know where they're from. So that's the bottom line. So practically, this mitzvah does not apply in terms of killing anybody, because we have no way to prove who actually hails from Amalek anymore. There are people out there, and maybe we can guess who they are, you know, possibly. But we are not allowed to kill anybody nowadays based on this, because we don't know genealogically if they really hail from Amalek or not. That's the bottom line. Now, who is this person Amalek? Where did he come from? Let's just get down the facts. You know, just the facts, please. Amalek descends from, you know, Yaakov had a brother Esav, children of Yitzchak Avinu, children of Isaac. And these two were, we look at as kind of antagonists of one another. They did fight in the Torah itself. We look at Esav as kind of the one who stands for the opposite of the Jewish people. Yaakov has a mission. Esav comes up against that mission. The rabbis tell us when Yaakov succeeds, Esav falls. When Esav succeeds, Yaakov falls. They have a relationship which is, what's the word? It's an inverse relationship. Sorry, inverse relationship. That's how the two of them work together. So Esav had a son named Eliphaz. It was Esav's son. And Eliphaz had it's called Pelegish in Hebrew, we call it a concubine, named Timnah. That's what the Torah tells us. And Eliphaz and Timnah gave birth to a son named Amalek. So essentially Amalek was Esav's grandson, the great-grandson of Isaac, the great-grandson of Abraham. That's what Amalek was. But coming through the line of Esav, he took on the evil traits which were there, all the wicked traits, and did not take on any of the positive traits of his grandfather, great-grandfather, or great-great-grandfather. So that's who Amalek came from. Now, just interesting points that Rashi points out in the Torah when it discusses the lineage of Amalek. The Torah has a very interesting verse, which is that, let me have it over here. This woman, Timnah, was Eliphaz's wife, and it tells you that at one place. Now, it also tells you about somebody else. There was someone named Seir, who was unrelated to Esav, and he was a powerful person. He was the head of a nation called Chor, and he had a child named Lotan. And the Torah happens to tell you a fact. The sister of Lotan was Timnah. So the Torah kind of crosses over these two lineages. There was somebody who was the king, the governor of this land called Chor. He had a son named Lotan, and the sister of Lotan was Timnah. Now, if you're following, this gets a little technical for a second. Following me. We'll get to the point in a minute. There's another place in the Book of Chronicles that actually says that Timnah was a daughter of Eliphaz. So on the one hand, she's spoken of Eliphaz's wife. She's said to be the daughter of this person named Seir, but also said to be the daughter of Eliphaz himself. So Rashi tells us that what happened, she was actually an illegitimate daughter of Eliphaz, because Eliphaz had an adulterous relationship with Seir's wife, and she gave birth to this daughter named Timnah. Therefore, Eliphaz actually married his own illegitimate daughter and gave birth to Amalek in that manner. That's what comes out. So you follow that, it's okay. But bottom line is that she was an illegitimate daughter based on an adulterous relationship with Eliphaz, who he married, and then she gave birth to Amalek from her and Eliphaz. Yeah.
I heard some good things about Timnah. That Timnah actually wanted to marry lineage of Jewish lineage.
Right, so that's what Rashi points that out as well.
She was spurned. She was spurned. And so then she had to go over to the other side, to the Esav side.
Right, so Rashi, that's a good point. Rashi says, Rashi says that Timna officially came from lineage of royalty because her quote-unquote father, who she thought was her father at least, Seir, was actually one of the governors of the land of Chur. But everybody so much respected the family of Abraham, they all wanted to cling somehow to Abraham's family. So she was willing to take on the concubine status and marry Abraham's grandson, great-grandson, Eliphaz, rather than maintain her royal lineage in her land of Chor. So Phil is pointing out, she wasn't a bad woman, necessarily. She could have been a nice woman. She was a subject to some bad circumstances. But she wanted to become part of Abraham's family. So she couldn't marry Yaakov's family, so therefore she married Esau's family. But that was all the lineage of Abraham. Abraham was respected in the world as a very important and holy man. But that's the genealogy of Amalek. So Amalek is the grandson of Esau, who came from the relationship of Eliphaz and Timna, which seems to be an illicit relationship because Timna was Eliphaz's daughter, according to Rashi. That's who Amalek was. Now, there's another interesting point, which is the following. If anybody recalls, at the end of Parshas Vayishlach, there is a long section of the Torah which discusses all of Esau's lineage. It goes on chapter after chapter. It gives you Esau's lineage and Hor's lineage and all these different facts, random details about Esau. And you always get there when you're reading the Torah and you say, why? Why do you need all this stuff? I mean, it seems to be, what are we learning from this? You know, what's the message here? It seems to be a waste of our time. I mean, the Torah is precious, and every word is precious, and why did God make us spend all this time reading about Esau's lineage, which seems to be irrelevant to Jewish people? So there's different approaches to this. Some give the answer, which is true, that in terms of, Kabbalistically, those verses carry a lot of meaning. In terms of mysticism, of Judaism, those verses are very, very important. But that's for people on very high levels to understand very deep things. But the Rambam, Maimonides, always tries to stick more to simple meanings. And he says, why is it the Torah goes off at length and discusses the lineage of Esav? It doesn't seem to be relevant to us. We know Esav's grandchild and great-grandchild and the kings that came from Esav years and years later. And we know the king's mother-in-law and where she's from and who her grandmother. I mean, there's all these random details in there. So the Rambam writes that the Torah goes at length describing the lineage of Esav because of this mitzvah. We have mitzvah to kill those who descend from Amalek. Now we have to figure out, well, who descends from Amalek? And Esav's family tree is quite messy. If you look through it, there's a lot of incestual relationships. They marry into other nations and back and forth. I mean, it's not a very clear lineage, straight shot, like parent, child. There's a lot of strange things in there. So if the Torah did not delineate exactly who was who, we wouldn't know who's actually Amalek. And the Rambam says that, no, we have a mitzvah to kill Amalek. We know what precious human life is. And anybody who's not Amalek, you don't go near them. And even the person looks like Amalek, and smells like Amalek, and is as scary as Amalek, and as wicked as Amalek. If they're not Amalek, you can't kill them. It's a human being. You're not a human being. God said you can kill Amalek. That's the only person you can kill. So you gotta know who Amalek is. Now you might have this attitude, yeah, well, this guy, you know, you meet someone, he's terrible, he's evil, he's wicked, he's probably Amalek. We know that he's part of Esav somewhere. You can't kill him, you have to know he's from Amalek. His human life is precious. So the Rambam says, the reason the Torah goes off at length describing the lineage of Esav is to make clear to us who is Amalek and who's not Amalek. And it's relevant to this part of Jewish law, which is we have mitzvah to eradicate Amalek, and we have to know who exactly descends and who does not descend from Amalek. That's what the Rambam writes. So that's the mitzvah. Again, bottom line, nowadays, we don't know who descends from Amalek anymore. Even if they say, well, I know I hailed from that country 2,000 years ago, we say it doesn't matter. That country wasn't necessarily Amalekites. That country was somebody else who was moved in there by the king Sennacherib of Assyria. That's what we would say. So don't kill anybody nowadays based on this halacha. But we have to understand it conceptually, because it's still relevant to us. God says you can never forget what they did to us. Year after year, we have to sit down and listen to the Torah being read about what they did. This is a Torah mitzvah. The custom is to read it the Shabbos prior to Purim. We in shul, we read the we take out a second Torah scroll, and we read this chapter about remembering what Amalek did to us. So obviously, it's a relevant concept for us even nowadays. So how does this work? And why are they so bad? I mean, plenty of nations have waged war with the Jews over history. Yet Amalek is the one who we say you have to make sure every single remnant of Amalek is destroyed from this earth. Well, what did they do that's so bad? So let me share with you an analogy that was given by Rav Shlomo Wolbe Zatzal, who was a great Jewish thinker lived in Israel, and he says the following. If you go down to, the Smithsonian has a, he has mentioned this part of it, the Smithsonian has a museum, the Air and Space has two parts. I don't know if you've been to the second part, the Advar Hazy Center, right by Dulles, right? So it's really, if you haven't been there, it's really cool, because the one downtown gives you a lot of information. The one near Dulles, you see all the planes and all the aircraft and helicopters and missiles. It's a really cool place. You have the space shuttle there now. So I was there a few years back, and they show you there a bus. And this was the bus, when the men first went to the moon, scientists were concerned they come back with moon germs, viruses, diseases, and the like. And they're quarantined in this bus for I think 2 weeks, just to have them examined prior to entering back into the Earth. So this bus is sitting in the Advar Hazy Center by Dulles Airport. And I guess the bus was equipped, airtight. I don't know how they did it, but it was equipped a way to quarantine them so if they had any special moon germs or moon viruses, it would not be introduced into Earth. So you can see this bus at Dulles Airport. So Rav Wolbe mentioned this bus. I don't think he ever went to Dulles Airport. But he mentioned this bus. And he says, the astronauts returned from the moon, and they were quarantined for all this time. I thought it was 2 or 3 weeks. It was a while. Because you don't want to introduce any new viruses or diseases to Earth. It could decimate the entire planet. I mean, if something is introduced which wasn't here before. So he says, let's flip it around for a second. Picture the moon. And let's say on the moon, you had some beings living there. And these beings were very, very spiritual people. Right? There's very spiritual beings living on the moon. Now this guy comes up from Earth, and he steps off the space shuttle into the moon. And these people are very, very upset. Because we've been maintaining this pristine spiritual environment for all this time. And now, I'm not nothing against these astronauts, but I'm saying now this human being who's been exposed to all these impurities down on Earth is coming in, he's going to contaminate our atmosphere. Atomic. In a spiritual sense. Atomic. Yeah, it's some form of toma, some spiritual disease which is introduced to the moon. Now Rav Wolbe says, again, this is kind of it's a cute idea to think about. Let's say the first person to step foot on the moon was a great tzaddik, the Chofetz Chaim, a very righteous person, a sage. How holy that moon be? Because the moon itself has been untouched by human hands for all these centuries, millennia. And now the first person to step foot on the moon would be this holy, holy man in this pristine atmosphere. And then it would be a holy place because never has it spiritually been defiled in any way. In any place of clarity of God, that's what it'd be like. So our world was like that. When Adam and Eve were created, when this world was first created, this world was spiritual, pristine. The Garden of Eden is a place where God was very clear. Before any evil was done, before evil is introduced. The verse says in Psalms that Shemayim Asaparim Kavod Kel, that the heavens call out the honor of God, and Maisa Yad Magid Harakia, the sky testifies to God's creation, God's handiwork. As we discussed, if you think about Amunah and faith in God and belief in God, things are pretty clear. You have to sit back and think about it. If you think about the beauty of this world, you think about the way God runs the world, you think about the complexity of nature, you can find God pretty easily in this world. In the Garden of Eden, God was apparent. It's interesting, even after Adam sins, he tries hiding from God because nowadays God hides from us. In the Garden of Eden, you had to hide from God. Because if you don't hide, you see God right in front of you. So he had to run and hide from God. Nowadays, God's hiding, we have to find him. It's the opposite. But Adam had to hide from God because there's such clarity in the garden. It's so pure and so pristine before any evil is introduced. So everything was clear. But what happened? God has to give us challenges. And God introduced to the world, we'll call a spiritual virus. There's a virus introduced. And once this virus is introduced, it spreads. It's something which catches. It's infectious. It's contagious. And this virus, we're talking on a spiritual level, it was the virus of the ability to not see God. It was a disease which made a human being be able to avoid God, to ignore God, to question God, which is something which is not natural for this world. This world is created by God, and God should be clear. But God had to give us our challenges. So therefore, God introduced something into the world. We'll discuss what that was. A spiritual disease, we'll call it, which infected, is contagious, which infected the entire world. And that's something which allows for the human being to then ignore God. That's what it means. And, we can even take it into, a physical metaphor of it. Sometimes the person, God forbid, can have a disease where, they're not thinking straight. That even though everything around them is clear, they don't perceive it that way. You know, God forbid someone with Alzheimer's, something like that. You know, it can affect the mind. And around you, everything is normal, but the person from the inside just can't see things correctly. That's what happens. So the world doesn't necessarily change, but the human being changes, because there's something introduced to the world which causes us to start questioning and doubting God. What do we call that? So we would call that a malik. That's what we would call that. Now, this is long before this person named a malik was born. But the rabbis tell us there's a few different links between a malik and the actual snake in the Garden of Eden. First and foremost, we say a malik is compared to, in rabbinic literature, he's called a snake. He's called, the Zohar calls him, other places call him the Echid Yabisha, this evil snake. A malik is referred to as a snake. But the snake in the Garden of Eden is actually a form of this power of a malik. It wasn't the physical human being named a malik, but there was a spiritual force in the snake, which is the force of a malik. And he was the one who tried to introduce evil to the world for the first time, and he succeeded. And he was able to convince Adam and Eve to sin. The Gemara, the Talmud tells us a very interesting thing. The Talmud tells us that it wants to know, where do you find a reference to Haman, to Haman in the Torah itself? Now, Haman lived, it was a good, I don't know, 2,000 years or so, 1,500 years or so after the Torah was given. But we want to find a reference to Haman in the Torah itself. So Gemara says, oh, I have the answer. What's the answer? Gemara says that if you look back at the story of the snake and Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, in Gan Eden, so Adam is hiding from God after he eats from the tree, and God says, where are you? Are you hiding from me? He finds him, and he says to him, did you eat from the tree, which I told you not to eat from? So the Hebrew term there is hamin ha'etz, did you eat from the tree? Hamin is the same exact hey mem, the same letters as haman. Same exact letters. So the rabbis say, look, there's a reference to Haman right there. That when God questions Adam, did you eat from the tree or not? It's already alluding to Haman. Haman, we said, descends from Amalek. Haman is the I guess the paradigm of what Amalek stands for in terms of Jewish thought, which is this force which comes to eradicate the Jews. And he's already alluded to in the sin of Adam and Eve. So Adam and Eve, by eating and internalizing from the tree, listening to the snake, they became infected. And they became, now they have this virus. The human race has a virus of a malik within them, which is hereditary within us. And now the world, even though the world around us should be clear, we should see God around every step of the way, in every corner, we have within us a disease which makes us question God. That's what we would say. Because we're all sick. You know, we're all sick with the disease of a malik. The Jews, like we read the account earlier, when the Jews were in the desert, the Torah says that they question, is God with us or not? And immediately a malik comes to attack, because that's the malik's chance. Because when we start questioning God, that's where they thrive. That's where they're able to succeed. It's interesting, a malik is also compared to a fly in rabbinic literature. And we know that flies usually thrive on things which are decaying, things that are rotting. Garbage is where they, you know, you put the garbage in the summer, sometimes you see a lot of maggots in there. You know, that's what flies thrive on, decay. And I'm all compared to a fly, because when they see people spiritually decaying, when they see people questioning God, that's when they're able to come in and poison us even more. That's the idea of a malik. Now, I read a thought recently from Rabbi Akiva Tatz, a fascinating, if you've heard of him, a fascinating writer, fascinating speaker. He has a book called World Mask. One of his earlier books. Fascinating, very fascinating book. Not easy read. It's, you have to really think through it. But he talks about this concept of Haman being alluded to in the term Hamin Ha'etz, did you eat from the tree? And it's interesting because the allusion, the reference to Haman is found in a question from God. God asks Adam, did you eat from the tree? Now, the obvious question is, of course, God knows he ate from the tree, right? God comes in and says, Adam, where are you? I can't find you. So, of course, he knows where he is. He says, did you eat from the tree? And, of course, he knows he ate from the tree. So, Rashi tells us, why is God saying these seemingly meaningless questions when he knows the answer? So, Rashi tells us, because God wants Adam to do tshuva, to repent. So he gives him a chance. Before he accuses him, he says, you're from the tree. So he wants Adam to say, yes, I did, God, I'm so sorry, I regret what I did. And he could have remained in the Garden of Eden at that time. That's what Rashi tells us. But Rabbi Tatz says, it's very interesting. When God starts asking questions like this, that could cause one to think, hey, God doesn't really know anything. God doesn't know the answer. Right? That's what Rabbi Tatz says. So Rabbi Tatz says, well, what's going on here? He says, because when the human being allows a malik to enter into them, and the human being starts questioning God, so God always reacts to us as we act towards him. If we act towards God in a questionable way, then God acts towards us also in that way. If we approach God with emunah, with faith, with certainty, then God acts to us with certainty. So as soon as Adam eats from the tree, and he ignores God, and he says, God doesn't really care, it's okay, he hides from God, he questions God's will, So God also responds in kind, Rabbi Tat says. And God says, okay, you question my will. Well, I'm going to show you that maybe that's a lock towards you as well. And I'll pretend like I don't notice you either. Maybe we want God to notice us. We don't want God to ignore us. So God comes around, hey, Adam, what's going on? Did you eat from the tree or not? As if he doesn't know. That's what Rabbi Tat says. It was a very interesting thought. But that's the power of Amalek. Amalek, which Haman is the one who comes from Amalek. Haman's the one who we're referring to in this pasuk, in this verse. Amalek is the one who's supposed to introduce to us questions, doubts. That's Amalek's job in this world. And God put him here for a reason. He's also a creation of God. But it's this person, Amalek is the one that embodies this disease. So it's a spiritual force which begins from the snake in the Garden of Eden, but it moves on into a physical nation, filters through Esav down to his grandson Amalek, and that results in Haman. And that results in the Purim story. But this disease, as you see it in the physical nation, is fascinating. The rabbis point out, you know, the Jews had just crossed the sea. They just experienced all the miracles of Egypt. Seemingly God was clear in the world. The nations all noticed it. The rabbis tell us that as the sea split, every single body of water in the world split as well. I mean, everybody saw that miracle happening in front of their own eyes in the entire world. This was God's big revelation. This is God's big spectacle to the entire world. So what happened? So in the song at the sea, as Yashir, as we say daily in the prayers, it records that all the nations at that point trembled in front of God. It says that the Philistines were snatched up with trembling. It says that the rulers of Edom were startled. It says that the powers in Moab, the Moabites, were terrified. It says all the settlers of Canaan had melted. They were so scared of God. But who was not mentioned there? Rabbis say Amalek wasn't mentioned there, because Amalek doesn't get scared of God. So Amalek's role in this world is to stand up against God. That's what they're here for. So everybody else in the nation at that point in the world respected God, revered God, noticed God's greatness in this world. But for Amalek, it was meaningless. Instead, you know, give it a few weeks, they attacked unprovoked. This is before the Jews even went to Mount Sinai. This is in between the splitting of the sea and Mount Sinai. The Jews are on their way to Mount Sinai to get the Torah. And unprovoked, Amalek attacks. They're not scared of God. They're not scared of these miracles. They have no reason to attack. They just want to get in the way of God. They just want to be the ones to somehow thwart God's plans in this world, which is their role. They're not able to develop a fear of God because their mission is to stand up against the fear of God. As the Torah tells us, the Torah says when they attacked, Lo Yarei Elokim, they didn't fear God. That's what it says in the Torah itself. Yeah.
They traveled
to do this, right.
A long distance to do this.
Yeah, right.
It wasn't like we're walking through and we're going to give them a hard time. It's like, no, they came 1,000 miles to do this.
Just to attack. That was it. And if you look through the history of Amalek's attacks upon the Jews, they always come right before big events. This first attack was right before the Jews went to Mount Sinai. The Jews are about to get God's Torah. Who comes to attack? Unprovoked, Amalek. The Jews battled Amalek prior to the building of the first temple, in the times of King Saul and King David. The battle of Purim against Amalek, this is shortly before the building of the second temple. This is when the Purim story happens, and the Jews are in exile after the destruction of the first temple, prior to going back to Israel to build the second temple. And who comes up against us again right before we go back to Israel to build the second temple? Amalek does. Because Amalek has to stand in the way of the Jews reaching any major milestone in history. And our tradition tells us that before the building of the third temple, we'll also destroy Amalek. Because for the world to reach its perfection, Amalek has to be destroyed. So there will be a third battle against, like it's a fourth battle against Amalek.
Say that one more time.
The tradition tells us that before the world reaches its perfection, in times of Mashiach, we have to destroy Amalek at that point. So there's going to be another battle against them around the times, I guess, before the building of the third temple, or shortly after. But there'll be a point where we have to battle them one more time to make sure it's totally eradicated. And only then can we succeed. Yeah. Well, that's like a prophecy, you know. Or it'll just happen. You know, if war happens and we just defeat a nation, God might say, you got them. You know, that might be it also. That could also happen. We don't know how it's going to unfold. But they always come up against us before we reach major milestones, and before we reach that final milestone of the perfection of the world, they're going to come against us again. And we have to destroy them at that point. Now, what's interesting is that, as we said, when they attacked the Jews had questioned God, is God with us or not, during this first attack, and immediately Amalek comes to attack. The Torah describes it, Asher karcha baderech, they happened upon you on the way. Now, they didn't really happen upon us. They came to attack us. And as Phil pointed out, they traveled on the offensive to attack us. The Torah calls it karcha. They happened upon you upon the way. So the rabbis take that word karcha in Hebrew, and they understand it a few different ways. The word karcha, number one, could come from the root kar, which means cold in Hebrew. If you're in Israel and you're cold, you say kar limod, I'm very cold. Kar means cold. And the rabbis, Rashi quotes it, they give us an analogy. They say, let's say there's a very, very hot bathtub. So the first person who jumps in will get burned. It'll cool the water for the rest of them. So what happened? The Jews left Egypt and experienced all these miracles. The Jews were on a high. And nobody would touch the Jews. We were a hot bathtub. Everyone thought they'd be scalded by us. Because God was with us. God performs miracles. God protects us. Amalek says, I can't stand for that. We can't have people revering the Jews and being scared of the Jews. I'm going to attack. And even though I'm going to lose, and I'm going to get scalded by the bathtub, at least now people will see the Jews are not invincible. They are vulnerable too, just like everyone else. That's what Amalek did. So their first attack against us, they're able to remove the fear of the other nations. As we said, when the Jews crossed the sea, all the nations were terrified of the Jews. We can't go near these people. These people are on a high. Amalek says, not so fast. I'm going to attack them, and we'll see they're vulnerable. Yes, Amalek lost the battle, and they're weakened, and Joshua succeeded with his army. But we see that the Jews are vulnerable, and they're able to set the tone for some history, that the Jews could be attacked. And we're always going to survive, we're always going to carry through, which has been the pattern throughout history. But we're not invincible, and you're able to attack the Jews. You're never going to totally win, because we're always going to carry on. God's with us, and we're going to succeed, and eventually we're going to thrive. We have our difficulties, we always move on. But the bathtub has been cooled, and now people do attack us, and it's the reverence for the Jews is not there anymore. The rabbis also tell us the word karcha could also come from the term mikra. Mikra means coincidence. Because what's a Amalek's job in this world? Don't have emunah. Don't think that things are planned by God. Don't think that God runs the show. Everything's a coincidence, happenstance. Karcha, they happen upon us. Because their attitude was everything is happenstance. Everything is just coincidence. Just kind of occurs. So we say it's not true. As we've discussed, God runs the show. Every step of the way, God is there behind it, making sure things go as they're supposed to go. Things are not coincidental. Everything here has a purpose. But Amalek's attitude is, no, karcha, things just kind of happened. There's a famous gematria, numerical value of Amalek. Amalek is the same numerical value as the word suffix, doubt. Because Amalek stands for doubt in this world. So the gematria of doubt is 240, and the gematria of Amalek is 240. Because Amalek stands for the concept of doubt. Because they create doubt. Without Amalek in this world, we would not doubt God. Everything would be clear. But the force of Amalek makes us doubt God. Again, on a physical level, because they show that Jews are vulnerable. You know, not so sure that God's with them. That's what they show on the physical plane. On the spiritual plane, they infuse doubts within us. They give us the spiritual disease to make us question God. The most interesting is when the Jews fought against Amalek, and we actually quoted this verse a few weeks back, the Torah uses a very fascinating term to describe the battle. We learned that Moshe's hands were in the air when he was on this mountain, and the Jews would succeed in battle. And the Torah says, "V'hai yadav emuna," his hands were emuna, until sunset. So the commentaries all struggle. What does it mean his hands were emuna? His hands were faithful, they were faith. So we discussed how his hands were consistent in being high up in the air so the Jews would win. But the term uses emuna. And commentaries point out, because the way you battle Amalek is essentially not on the battlefield. It's in the spiritual world, because the more emunah the Jews have, the less place Amalek has to infect us. The antidote, the vaccine against Amalek, against this spiritual germ, is emunah. The more we strengthen our emunah, our faith in God, if our hands are emunah, like it says, if our hands are faithful to God at all times, so that's when we're able to destroy Amalek. But the more doubt we have, which we said, suffik is the numerical value of Amalek, the more doubts that we have of God, that's when Amalek is able to attack us. And that's what he said. When the Jews question, is God with us or not? Immediately Amalek comes in to attack. And that's what the Torah tells us. But the way you fight Amalek, like Moshe did, is through emunah. The more that we strengthen our emunah, we strengthen our connection to God, our study of Torah, the more we strengthen ourselves, at that point we're able to destroy Amalek. There are many people out there that we like to refer to as Amalek. And like I said, practically we're not allowed to kill anybody nowadays as a descendant of Amalek, because we don't know who actually descends from Amalek. Rabbinic literature, different commentaries, and the later commentaries, recent commentaries, have been able to find different correlations between Amalek and more modern Jewish tragedies. Such, namely, the Holocaust is one very famous connection made between the Megillah of the Purim and the Holocaust. You may have heard it before, between the Nuremberg trials and the Ten Sons of Haman, etc. I'm sure you can Google it, you can find a whole write-up about that. And the sources are very, very, very clear. I mean, it's very interesting. But look, you know, typically any major tragedy that occurs to the Jews, there's some ways related back to Amalek. Now, you might need a great sage to tell you how it relates. The Chasam Sofer, which I think we quoted him last week, Rav Moshe Sofer, you know, one of the Torah greats of the 19th century. So he actually writes his commentary on the Megillah that there was terrible tragedies which occurred to the Jews in 1648, 1649. Northern Hebrew is the Gzeros Tach V'Tat, in the Ukraine, led by a terrible man named Bogdan Khmelnytsky, Machshavah V'Zichro. You can, if you don't know the history, the Jews were tortured and persecuted and killed in terrible, terrible ways during those 2 years by the Cossacks and the army of this Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the Khmelnytsky massacres. And the Chasam Sofer finds in Megillas Esther a reference to these massacres. Because again, whenever you find a terrible, evil person coming against the Jews, typically you can find that person's reference somewhere within the realm of Amalek. Because Amalek is the one whose sole purpose in this world is to destroy every single Jew they could possibly destroy, and stand up against God's people and God's will in this world. I'm sure you can find more references as well to other tragedies. Those are the two that come to mind, the Holocaust and these massacres in 1648-1649. They're both, I've seen references in literature from the Megillas Esther, linking them to Haman and to Amalek. The Amalek also, we talked about the gematria of Amalek being suffix, being doubt, 240, the numerical value 240. There's also another few interesting points about their name. Number one, Amalek in Hebrew could be broken up into two words, Am Kal, insignificant nation. So on the one hand, they're insignificant in the scheme of history in that, you know, in God's plan, ultimately they're going to be destroyed and gone. But also, they're the ones who are able to show. What they try to do is they try to show the insignificance of all important things in this world. Anything of real importance, anything of lasting value, they come up and devalue it. They say, they belittle it. They say it's worthless to me. You don't need that. It's not worth anything. You want to go get the Torah Mount Sinai? Yeah, that's not important. You say there's God in the world? Not important. It's all coincidental. And that's what they try to do. And there's a term used by Amalek's grandfather, Esav. It describes Esav as Vayivez Esav. Esav belittled when he sold the birthright to Yaakov. Famous story. So after he sells the birthright, what does the Torah tell us? Esav Vayivez. Yivez is he shamed it. He belittled it. He devalued the birthright. He says, it's meaningless. It doesn't matter. It says this about Haman as well. When he wanted to kill Mordechai, Vayivez Be'enav. It was worthless in his eyes. The same term is used. The rabbis say that it's the quality of this nation. Amalek is in Hebrew we call it mevazeh, bizayon. It's too little, to belittle, to ridicule, to devalue all of importance. And that's the concept of a lot. When there's a muna, when we believe in God and see God in this world, so events are important because they're going somewhere. They're meaningful in the big picture. If everything's coincidental, then what's really important? If it's all these things kind of happen as they do, nothing's really important because it's not going anywhere. It's not for any purpose in life. It just kind of occurs. So Amalek stands to, they say nothing's really important out there. No, there's no God. There's no purpose. You're not going anywhere. Things are coincidental. So therefore, okay, you know, nothing's of value. There's another gematria, numerical value of Amalek, which is the term El Acher, other God, another God. It's very interesting. The Torah in two places, Medrash actually has large letters. There's sometimes you look at a Torah scroll, there's some letters which we have a tradition to make larger. There's sometimes we have a tradition to make them smaller. We have certain different traditions we have in a Torah scroll. So one pair of enlarged letters, which the rabbis point out to us, is in Shema. So in Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, in the word Echad, God is one, the Dalet is enlarged. In the term, there's the polar opposite of proclaiming God is one, is don't bow down to Avodah Zarah, to idolatry. Don't accept to other gods. And there the Torah says, Lo Sishtachve Le'el Acher, don't bow down to another god. And there the Resh, Acher, is enlarged. So these are two opposites. There's God is one, Hashem Echad, Shema, the Dalet's enlarged. There's idolatry, El Acher, other powers, other gods, and the Resh is enlarged. So Amalek stands for this El Acher. They try to tell you, there's other powers out there, other things that are important. Forget about the one and only God. There's other things out there which also have power. But what's important about these two letters, which, you know, we're out of time. This could be a long explanation, but I'll give you the short version, is that, so we have a Dalet of God as one, and we have a Resh of other powers. The the concept of mixing up the one only God with other powers is referred to in the Torah with these two letters. For instance, after Adam ate from the tree and sinned, God comes to him with a curse. And he says that there's going to be, you're going to farm, there's going to be weeds growing up in your crops and thorns. So the Hebrew term used there is kutz v'dardar. There'll be thorns and dardar and weeds. So dardar is these two letters, dalad and resh, meaning that once you eat from the tree, Adam, you're going to confuse. You're going to get confused between your dalad, your one and only God, and your resh, and other powers. You're going to get confused now. When it says we're going to fight Amalek for all generations, the term used, a generation here, is a door. And we say, midor, door. Now usually, door could have a vav in it, dalad vav resh. And also, you usually say, dor vador is usually the term. But it says there, door, which is, again, dalad and resh, those two letters. Because, again, when someone comes into the picture, your dalad of God is one, and your resh of their other powers out there get confused. The great Vilna Gaon writes that when the Jews worship the golden calf, so Moses is up on Mount Sinai, and God says, hey, there's bad things going on down there. You have to go down, and you have to talk to them and see what they're doing. So the term God uses is lech raid, go down, raid, resh dalad. So the Vilna Gaon writes, because the Jews have now confused their dalad and their resh. The Dalit of God is one. They've confused it. They have other gods now. Raid, go down. As he tells them. And there's a lot of examples of this. But Amalek stands for the Gematria 240, El Acher, other gods, because their role in this world is to tell you there's other powers out there. Why are you so set on this one and only God? There's other things that are important, other powers out there, the things besides Hashem, which should be focused on. Ultimately, we'll close with this. The Torah tells us in the prophecy of Bilam, the non-Jewish prophet that we talk about in the book of Bamidbar, he says, Reishis goyim Amalek. Amalek is the first of nations, acharisu adi oved, but his end, his destiny is destruction. And commentators point out that, you know, everybody has their place in the perfection of the world. You know, it's not only Jews, non-Jews too. Other non-Jewish nations, when the world reaches perfection, they'll find their place. Amalek has no place in the future. When the world reaches perfection, Amalek has to be destroyed. Number one, because they are the antithesis of it. They stand to prevent us from getting to that point. So by definition, if they exist in this world, we can't reach that point. But if they don't exist, that's when we will reach that point. Other nations, they don't stand, even if they're nations which might come against the Jews. Other nations have battled the Jews over the centuries. But they're not polar opposites. They're not the antagonists of Jewish belief. They have other goals. They want land, they want power. Well, money, they want servants, they don't like what we do for other reasons, but they have value, they're people of value, the nations have value, and eventually they can channel their talents into God's will, into God's perfection. Amalek has nothing to offer us. Amalek has nothing to offer the world. Amalek is total evil. They totally stand up against the Jews, stand up against God, and therefore there's no place, in a world of perfection, there's no place for Amalek. They have to be destroyed, they can't be here. That's why the victory against Amalek is always, it's very interesting. If you notice the places where the Torah discusses the battle against Amalek, there's always this focus on the word tomorrow, which is there. If you look, when Moses fights the Amalek in the book of Shmos, in the Torah itself, Moses says, tomorrow I'm going to stand on the mountain. Tomorrow I'm going to stand on the mountain. Why does he stand there today? Why is it important that it's tomorrow? When King David fights Amalek, it talks about battling tomorrow. He battled them today and tomorrow, it says. When Esther comes to destroy Haman, she has to have to destroy him tomorrow at the second party she makes. She makes one party with the king. It's not your time to destroy Amalek, to kill Haman. She says, tomorrow I'll tell you what I want. And she has a second party tomorrow and destroys him. Why? Because Amalek, the battle against Amalek is the battle for tomorrow. I mean, if we destroy Amalek in the future, and that's when the world reaches perfection. The present times where we do have our struggles and our doubts, this is Amalek's time to thrive. The place where Amalek gets destroyed is always in the tomorrow. That's what happens. And there will be a tomorrow, Amalek will get destroyed, they're going to fall, and the world will be just perfection. So, it's our job to remember, let's go back to you know, Art asked the question. It says, destroy the memory of Amalek, but remember Amalek. But what does it say remember? It says, remember what they did. That's what it says. It doesn't say remember them. Remember what they did to us, and destroy their memory. Because we have to remember what they did to us, because we also have to struggle with, it's not only relevant to that battle. It's relevant to us each and every day because they've infused in us on a daily basis this ability to doubt God, this virus as we called it. So we have to always remember that because if we forget about that, we have to call a spade and realize that we do have our doubts and we do have our challenges. We can't forget about that. But we have to know that they have to be obliterated because ultimately once we obliterate them, then our doubts also fall away as well. Our doubts will melt away. All of our doubts are here because of this force in the world. When we're able to eliminate our doubts, we'll be able to physically destroy them. When we physically destroy them, our doubts will be eliminated. It goes both ways. And eventually our doubts will melt away, everything will be clear, and a world without Amalek, and that's when the world can really thrive and reach its perfection. So as Purim comes around, this is the first thought. Amalek comes to destroy, question Amunah, question God. Haman is the one who hails from Amalek. We have to make sure eventually that every single remnant, the physical and spiritual of Amalek, is destroyed, because they are the ones who stand up against everything this world is supposed to be to stand for. And that's their role in this world. God put him here for a reason. God has to create a challenge for us. He has to make it interesting, or else we have nothing to accomplish. But ultimately, our job is to destroy Amalek from within ourselves, our own personal doubts and questions in Emunah. Destroy Amalek as a physical nation, whoever they may be, and that will lead the world to its perfection.